From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Stephen King describes the car accident that nearly killed him and what it was like to experience the kind of pain he had only imagined for his fiction. He's still recovering from his injuries, which included a fractured knee and right hip, a shattered leg broken in 9 places, 4 broken ribs, a collapsed lung, and 8 chips in his spine. He writes about the accident and reflects on his work in his new book on writing. Also today, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD of music composed by Samuel Barber. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan says he believes Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat wants to calm the situation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. He also said he believes 3 Israeli soldiers kidnapped by Hezbollah are still alive. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Kofi Annan today met Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak after a meeting with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat last night. Annan said he will try to see the 3 captured Israeli soldiers when he goes to Lebanon.
What is important is that the soldiers not be harmed, they should be kept in good health, and I do agree with the Prime Minister that Red Cross should be given access to them immediately and without conditions.
Annan also called on both the Israeli and Palestinian leaders to return to the negotiating table. He said the region has suffered too much and that both sides should move forward. Barak said it's still not clear if President Clinton will come to the region for a summit. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
NASA has decided to scrub this evening's planned launch of the Space Shuttle Discovery. The space agency says it's concerned about a piece of equipment that was left on the structure supporting the shuttle's fuel tank. Engineers feared that the part, an 8-ounce metal pin, could have damaged the space vehicle during liftoff. The launch is being rescheduled for tomorrow. Vice President Al Gore campaigned on education issues today in Florida, outlining proposals to hire more teachers and make thousands of dollars of tuition fees tax-deductible. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
Gore introduced the proposal today as he took some time off preparing for tomorrow night's debate and visited a community college in Bradenton. Gore said big changes were needed in the country's education policy.
I think it's time to recruit 100,000 new well-trained teachers and start treating teachers like the professionals that they are and give them lower class sizes.
Gore said that he wanted to make at least 2 years of college an expectation for today's graduating high school seniors. Gore also said under his plan, up to $10,000 a year in college tuition would be tax deductible. He says that would put college within reach of many more Americans. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
Republican nominee George W. Bush campaigned today in Al Gore's home state of Tennessee, saying the vice president used to live here but was now of Washington, for Washington, and by Washington. Bush stopped in eastern Tennessee on his way to Greenville, North Carolina, where he'll prepare for tomorrow's second debate with Gore. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 44 points to close at 10,524 in moderate trading. The technology-heavy NASDAQ Composite Index lost 115 points, or 3.4%. This is NPR News. The Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Portland, Oregon, has settled a lawsuit filed by 22 men who claimed they were sexually abused by a priest. The terms of the settlement weren't revealed, but it includes an apology to be read in every church in the archdiocese. The accused priest, who's now 80, is in the Alzheimer's unit of a suburban Portland nursing home. Nobel Prizes for Chemistry and Physics will go to inventors who've ushered in the electronics era and who could push that field farther ahead. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
3 chemists working at the University of Pennsylvania started tinkering with plastics to understand more about how that material differs from metals. They ended up inventing plastics capable of doing what metal does, carrying electricity. Alan Heeger, Alan McDiarmid, and Hideki Shirakawa will share the Chemistry Nobel Prize for that work. These plastics could end up being the future of electronics. The physics committee recognized past pioneers from the world of microelectronics. They honored Jack Kilby, who built the first computer chip in 1958. And they also recognized the work of Herbert Kromer and Zores Alfyorov. Working independently, those scientists figured out astounding things to do with semiconductors, including making chips that emit laser light. Richard Harris, NPR News, Washington.
The New Hampshire State Senate has overwhelmingly voted to acquit the head of the state Supreme Court in an impeachment trial. Chief Justice David Brock was accused of improperly passing information to a fellow justice about that justice's divorce case and later lying to House investigators about it. Senators said the evidence against Brock wasn't persuasive. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Stephen King was nearly killed in June of last year while taking his daily walk. He was walking along the gravel shoulder of Route 5, a two-lane highway near his home in Maine, when he was struck by a van driven by Brian Smith, who had several prior convictions for speeding and reckless driving. Last month, Smith was found dead in his home. The autopsy was inconclusive. The results of toxicology tests are expected to take several months. King is still recovering from his injuries, which included 9 breaks in his right leg, his right knee split almost directly down the middle, a fracture of his right hip, 4 broken ribs, and a scalp laceration that required nearly 30 stitches. His spine was chipped in 8 places. Yet he's still writing, and he's made news for the way he's used the internet to publish recent work. His new book is a real book, not a virtual one. It's called On Writing, and it's part memoir, part reflections on his craft. The last chapter is about his accident. Let's start with a reading.
Most of the sight lines along the mile of Route 5, which I walk, are good. But there is one stretch, a short, steep hill, where a pedestrian walking north can see very little of what might be coming his way. I was 3/4 of the way up this hill when Brian Smith, the owner and operator of the Dodge van, came over the crest. He wasn't on the road. He was on the shoulder, my shoulder. I had perhaps 3/4 of a second to register this. It was just time enough to think, my God, I'm going to be hit by a school bus. I started to turn to my left. There is a break in my memory here. On the other side of it, I'm on the ground, looking at the back of the van, which is now pulled off the road and tilted to one side. This recollection is very clear and very sharp, more like a snapshot than a memory. There is dust around the van's taillights. The license plate and the back windows are dirty. I register these things with no thought that I have been in an accident or of anything else. It's a snapshot, that's all. I'm not thinking. My head has been swapped clean. There's another little break in my memory here, and then I am very carefully wiping palmfuls of blood out of my eyes with my left hand. When my eyes are reasonably clear, I look around and see a man sitting on a nearby rock. He has a cane drawn across his lap. This is Brian Smith, 42 years of age, the man who hit me with his van. Smith has got quite the driving record. He has racked up nearly a dozen vehicle-related offenses. Smith wasn't looking at the road on the afternoon our lives came together because his Rottweiler had jumped from the very rear of his van into the back seat area where there was an igloo cooler with some meat stored inside. The Rottweiler's name is Bullet. Smith has another Rottweiler at home. That one is named Pistol. Bullet started to nose at the lid of the cooler. Smith turned around and tried to push Bullet away. He was still looking at Bullet and pushing his head away from the cooler when he came over the top of the knoll, still looking and pushing when he struck me. Smith told friends later that he thought he'd hit a small deer until he noticed my bloody spectacles lying on the front seat of his van. They were knocked from my face when I tried to get out of Smith's way. The frames were bent and twisted, but the lenses were unbroken. They are the lenses I'm wearing now as I write this. Smith sees I'm awake and tells me help is on the way. He speaks calmly, even cheerily. His look, as he sits on his rock with his cane drawn across his lap, is one of pleasant commiseration. "Ain't the two of us just had the shittiest luck," it says. He and Bullet left the campground where they were staying, he later tells an investigator, because he wanted some of those Maz's buys they have up to the stoa. When I hear this little detail some weeks later, it occurs to me that I have nearly been killed by a character out of one of my own novels. It's almost funny.
That's Stephen King reading from his new memoir on writing. Stephen King, welcome back to Fresh Air, and it's so great to still have you with us.
It's nice to be here, but I tell people nowadays it's nice to be anywhere.
Right. Did Smith say anything to you, anything else to you, as you were laying there drifting in and out of consciousness after he hit you?
He said, "I've never had so much as a parking ticket in my life, and here it is my bad luck to hit the best-selling writer in the world." And I think he said, "I loved all your movies."
Did he really say that?
Yeah.
So he's lying to you as you're lying there, nearly dying?
Well, he said he had never had so much as a parking ticket, and God knows he had a lot of traffic offenses. We don't want to speak ill of the dead if we can help it, because he did die last month, and on my birthday, as a matter of fact, which
no.
is a little bit eerie.
Yeah.
He and I share the same middle name as well. We're both Edwins. We were. Now I'm, well, never mind.
You know, in that reading, you say that it made you think that he was like a character in your fiction. Were there other things that made you think of him that way?
Well, God knows that I've lived in rural Maine for a lot of years. It's where I grew up, and it's where my wife and I live now, in a town of about 900 people. And we don't want to say that Brian Smith is or was a type, because I don't necessarily believe that there are types, but he had a certain backcountry quality with the Rottweiler dogs and the old van, and it's really tough, Terry, to talk about Brian Smith without making him sound like a sort of Faulknerian stereotype, and so I'd just as soon steer clear of the whole issue. He was like a character in a Stephen King book, but only because he seemed like a real Maine type to me.
You were understandably really angry with the sentence that he was given. He was basically given a suspended driver's license for a year. But when he was found dead in his home toward the end of September, what was your reaction to his death?
Oh, I was shocked, and I was sorry as well. When he hit me, Brian Smith was 42. When he died, he was 43, and 43 isn't a natural span, I don't believe, for a man in 21st century America.
Did you feel like this was like some kind of larger form of punishment, or that his death was related in any kind of larger way to this accident?
No, I don't think that the world works that neatly, and I don't think that justice is meted out by fate, or else people like Adolf Eichmann wouldn't have lived so long, so well, before anybody caught up to them. And God knows there are enough people whose crimes would make anything that Brian Smith ever did look very small change in comparison, who have never been punished at all. My feeling about Brian Smith was pretty simple. He had a very long record of driving convictions, and an even longer record. In the book, I talk about the dozen or so traffic convictions. But in fact, he had been brought before the courts on twice that many charges, where the charges were either dismissed or they under the seal of the court because he was a juvenile. These go back to the time of his driver's permit. And we're not dealing with somebody here who is a bad person or in the sense that you'd want to see somebody sent to jail for robbery or murder or rape or any of those things. Brian Smith was just a bad, negligent driver, and I wanted to see him take it, not necessarily put in jail, but certainly put into a situation where he'd be forced to consider the way that he was behaving, you know, on a wide range of issues, from the way that he was driving to the way that he was living.
Stephen King is my guest, and he does have a new book that's called On Writing, a Memoir of the Craft. Tell us about how you're feeling now, your ability to walk and all that.
Well, the accident was in June of 1999, and I was totally incapacitated at that point. If there was a bone on the right side of my body, it was broken, with the exception of my head, which was only concussed. And this is about 16 months down the line, and I'm able to walk fairly well. I have a limp that I think is a lot more noticeable toward the end of the day as things start to hurt more. I've continued to work rehab in order to increase my range of motion. It doesn't seem to do a whole lot for some of the pain issues that are centered around the hip, but most of the leg is pretty pain-free now, and I'm grateful for that, and it's nice to be able to walk at all. The way it works, when you are in the hospital and you're stuck in bed and you've got various appliances attached to your body, you say to people, "Will I ever get out of this bed?" And they say, "The chances are good." And when you get out of bed, you say, "Will I ever be able to bend my leg again?" And they say, "The chances are good that you will." Most people do. So that, and that continues to go on, "Will I walk again?" And the last question, the one that I'm working on right now, as I said to the doctor about the orthopedist, David Brown, who operated on my leg, I said, "I'd really like to be able to play tennis. Will I be able to do that maybe next summer?" And he said, "I think that the chances are fairly good that you'll be able to run again and play tennis." So nobody comes out and says yes. They just tell you that the chances are good, I suppose, because they don't want you to be depressed. But I'm walking, I'm thinking, and I'm really, really grateful to be alive.
Do you need a walker or a cane, anything like that?
No. I went from two crutches. I went from a wheelchair to a walker, and walker to crutches, and two crutches to one crutch, and put the last crutch aside in July, and I've been walking unaided since then. My wife says that she's encouraged by the trail of discarded appliances I've left behind.
I'm glad you've left them behind. For your writing, you've had to imagine people in extreme circumstances and imagine them in agony. Did your accident feel like anything you had imagined for fiction?
It all seemed familiar to me in the sense that there was nothing involved with the whole deal that I didn't expect. But the odd thing is that when you've been seriously hurt, there's a kind of numbing shock that sets in. And as a result, everything is, there's no surprise involved with any of the things that seem to go on. You just sort of, the things come and you deal with them. It's like being cast adrift and riding the waves. They took me to a hospital in Western Maine and did a few things to me. They took a look at the injuries and decided that they couldn't treat them there. And they got a life flight helicopter to take me to Central Maine Medical Center in Lewiston. And while I was on the flight, my lung collapsed. And I can remember one of the guys saying, "Oh, shit, we've got to do something about this." And I can remember the crackle of them unwrapping something and somebody saying that they were going to stick me. And then I could breathe again because they'd intubated me and pumped up my lung again. And all of this was just a sort of sense of, well, this is what's happening now. You become a totally passive person in a way. You recognize immediately that you've been seriously hurt and that you can't deal with your own life and that you're going to have to depend on other people to pull you through. So you just kind of let go. And that's pretty much the way that I always saw things happening in my books, which doesn't surprise me that much, because I think the imagination, when you really use it at top quality, when you're seeing really well, the imagination really knows what the reality is.
My guest is Stephen King. His new book is called On Writing, A Memoir of the Craft. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Stephen King is my guest. His new book is called On Writing, A Memoir of the Craft. In an interview in Salon magazine before the accident, you said, "As a kid, my mother used to say when we were scared, whatever you're afraid of, say it three times fast and it will never happen." And that's what I've done in my fiction. Basically, I've said out loud the things that really terrify me, and I've turned them into fictions, and they've made a very nice living for me, and it seems to have worked. Did you ever feel that this time the horror stories jinxed you, that something that you feared and had written about was coming true?
No, it never even crossed my mind. It's strange because off and on in my career as a writer, I have certainly written about car crashes and about characters who've been hurt or injured in car crashes. There's a little boy who's killed by a truck in Pet Sematary. And in a book that's done in manuscript but hasn't been polished yet and readied for publication called From a Buick 8, one of the main characters' father is killed in an accident very similar to the one that almost killed me. But I only use those things in my stories because cars and traffic accidents are a part of our lives. They're something that, unfortunately, most of us relate to. Probably at a rate of three or four times as much. That is to say, three or four times as many people either have been in a car accident themselves or know somebody who has, as have been injured with gunshots. So it's a part of the American experience, and as such, of course, I've written about it, but I never felt that I jinxed myself, no.
When you were on Fresh Air a few years ago and we were talking about the things that scared you most as a kid, you mentioned something that you also describe in your new book on writing. You talked about how when you were a kid you had strep throat, and after that you had a terrible ear infection. And in treating it, the doctor had to, with a needle, puncture your eardrum on three separate occasions to let the infection drain. And it was the worst agony you'd ever experienced. And of course, the doctor, before doing the procedure, kept saying that it wasn't going to hurt. You've had to go through excruciating pain as an adult now as a result of the accident and the procedures and therapies that you've had to do as well. How is dealing with the pain of the accident, the surgeries, the procedures, dealing with that pain as an adult compared to dealing with it as a child?
Well, as an adult, I always felt a lot more as though I were a participant in what was happening to me. For instance, the therapy. And anybody who's been in a bone-crunching accident knows that it's a very, very difficult procedure to go through. When I woke up, I was in something that's called an external fixator, which is a halo that goes over the leg, and it mobilizes the bone. It also immobilizes the joints, so that from June 19th, I think, until probably, toward the end of July, I never bent my knee. And in the old days, the 20s and 30s, when people recovered from this sort of accident, their leg was more or less frozen in place, so it became an organic crutch. And nowadays, at least we have therapeutic techniques to restore mobility to the leg, but it's very, very painful. And I can remember, in the On Writing book, I talk about the having my ears lanced to let out, to drain moisture and pus that was behind the eardrum. But as a child, when you're faced with a procedure like that, you're in a uniquely powerless situation because you don't understand what's going on. And you're powerless to stop it in any case. You were mentioning I had to go back three times. And the first time when I was told, "Don't worry, this won't hurt," I believed it. The second time, I almost believed it. And the third time, I knew that it wasn't true, but I was still powerless to stop it. And to me, that's the ingredient of a nightmare, even down to the fact that the doctor never called me Stephen. He called me Robert. He would say, "Now, Robert, lie down. This won't hurt." And in my panicky child's way, I'm thinking, "Of course it will hurt. Of course it will hurt. You're even lying about what my name is." But when you get to be an adult, although it still hurts, the pain is still there. I felt as though I were something of a participant in my own therapy, so that the first step was to get the knee to flex enough so that the leg would come down and the heel would touch the floor. And the pain of just that was excruciating, and I just filled the house with my howls. I can't imagine how my poor wife ever stood it, but the physical therapist, Ann, just would laugh and say, "You can do a little bit more, Stephen." And I'd think, "No, I can't. I can't do any more, Ann. Stop it. Let me stop." And she wouldn't, and then come the weights on the leg and all the rest of it. But you, at least you know what's going on, and you know, understand what the stakes are. And when it came to having my ear lanced, children just don't understand.
You know, in Misery, the character, the main character, is a writer who's seriously injured, and the woman taking care of him, his number one fan, is really torturing him and not giving him therapy. Did the nurses and therapists who you worked with make zillions of Misery jokes?
You know, they'd all read Misery, but and they worked for an outfit called the Bangor Area Visiting Nurses. These are nurses who go into the home and give home care. And I think one of them told me toward the end of the period where I needed full-time nursing that they had all read it and they had all been called into the office by their superior and told in no uncertain terms, "Don't make any Misery jokes."
And did they restrain themselves?
They did. They were great.
Stephen King. He'll be back in the second half of the show. His new book is called On Writing. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Saab, introducing its new 2001 lineup, featuring the OnStar voice-activated telematics system. Information available at SaabUSA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, painkillers and hallucinations. We continue our conversation with Stephen King about recovering from the car accident that nearly killed him. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of music composed by Samuel Barber. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Stephen King. He's still recovering from the car accident that nearly killed him last year. He started writing again just a few weeks after the accident. His new book on writing is part reflection on his craft, part memoir. You write in the book that at some point you had to admit to yourself that you had serious problems with alcohol and with cocaine. Because your wife organized an intervention, you finally did something about it and got over those addictions. After the accident, you had to take some pretty heavy painkillers.
Right.
And those are pretty addictive. What's it like having to go back on drugs, addictive drugs, knowing that you'd had a problem with them and that you have what you describe as an addictive personality?
One of the ways that the way that it was described best to me, you know that people who are alcoholics and drug addicts generally get involved with support groups that have names that suggest that you shouldn't talk about them at the level of press, TV, radio, and films. And so I don't, but I do know a lot of people as a result of attending those meetings who have the same problem that I do. And I heard one guy who'd been through this himself describe it as being in one of those log rolling competitions where you get up on a log and you see how long you can stay up before you get dumped back into the river. If I thought anything was unfair about what had happened to me, it was that after struggling and winning a battle to get off all sorts of drugs and alcohol, and I just didn't have a problem with beer and cocaine. I was an addictive personality, period. I was smoking two packs of cigarettes a day. I loved Listerine. I loved NyQuil. You name it, boy, if it would change your consciousness, I was all for that. And I was able to jettison almost all of those substances out of my life. And suddenly you wake up in a hospital bed and you've got a fentanyl patch on your arm and you're jacked up on morphine and you've got all these different medications. I was as grossed out by that, I think, as I was by the injuries, thinking, my God, I'm a junkie again. And the way that I deal with it, rightly or wrongly, is to try and make sure that you never exceed the dosage that you're supposed to have for things like Percocet or Vicodin or any of those things. And as long as you stay below the prescribed levels and as long as you're making a reasonable effort to get clean, that's a good thing to do. On the other hand, as other people say in those programs that I attend, I didn't get sober to suffer. And if I'm in a situation where I'm miserable and medication will help that suffering, I'm going to take it.
You still have to take painkillers?
I'm almost off, but I still do take some. Yeah, toward the end of the day. Mostly, though, I'm clean.
Is it hard to keep your...
There's no such mostly for an alcoholic and drug
addict. Yeah, right. Is it hard to keep your mind clear? You know, that's what people always complain about with painkillers. It helps the pain, but it's hard to think clearly.
I think it depends on what you take. I've never detected any emotional or mental change at all with the stuff that I take. Most of it is time release, and that might be why. But there certainly doesn't seem to be any buzz.
Now, I think early on when you're on the real heavy-duty painkillers, that you there'd be some...
You know, if I can just interrupt, yeah. with the heavy-duty painkillers, there's a buzz, but you don't enjoy it because you're totally screwed up.
Right. But I think there were hallucinations that came along with some of that early on.
There were a lot of hallucinations, very unpleasant.
Yeah, I'm thinking your mind is wild enough without the hallucinations. I mean, like, you have all these visions for these great stories that you write all the time, and they're kind of, you know, crazy and scary enough. So what's it like when your mind hallucinates?
Well, at the time that I had the accident, I was working on the book that we're talking about, On Writing. But the book before that I'd published was called The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon. And it was about a little girl who gets lost in the woods and she survives from day to day. She's got a little Walkman radio with her and she listens to the Red Sox baseball games. And her hero is Tom Gordon, a real person who's the closer for the Boston Red Sox. And after the accident, when I was going through surgeries and I was being loaded up with morphine, loaded up with Versed, whatever it is that they give you when they operate on you, and then they bring you out and the stuff for pain, I became convinced that Tom Gordon had killed his entire family, a la O.J. Simpson, and that I was hiding in some sort of a hospital from him because he might come and get me. And this was all totally in my mind. Tom Gordon is a wonderful guy. He's a wonderful family man. And I just, who knows where it came from, but it was just total hallucination. And I had decided that there was this fellow who might be my friend in this hospital who was in charge of physical therapy. He was like a phys ed instructor with a lot of muscles in and a white shirt and the white duck pants and everything. And this guy turned out to be the orthopedic surgeon who'd actually put me back together again. He must have come into the operating room at some point where I'd regained a little edge of consciousness, but because of the drugs that I was on, I was convinced he was a character. In fact, I seemed to be a character in one of my own books, and that was a very frightening place to be.
Yeah, I would imagine. Do you think that you got any ideas from these hallucinations that you would use in a book?
From the entire experience and having the broken leg and recovering from the broken leg, those things I've used already in a book called Dreamcatcher, where there's a character who is a history professor who's struck in Cambridge and has a broken leg and a broken hip, and the things that he goes through in the hospital. I would say that there's a surrealistic touch to some of that that approaches those hallucinations, but certainly I have not used any of that stuff at this point. And I might someday, I really might, but those memories have faded a little bit for me. There's this saying that if women really remember labor pains, every child would be an only child. And I think that whatever sort of serious pain that you have, your mind casts a veil over that, so it's difficult to remember it in any detail. But I also think, as a writer, that a lot of that stuff, in On Writing, I talk about muses that I call the boys in the basement, because usually when we think about muses, we think about these airy-fairy little female sprites that kind of float around your head flinging this inspired happy dust, whereas I think of them as these guys, these blue-collar guys who live in the basement and they sit around drinking beer and, you know, telling dirty jokes, and every now and then you go down and say, do you have any ideas for me? And the guy looks at you and says, yeah, I got an idea. Yeah, here it is. Now go get to work and don't bother me anymore. I got to polish my bowling trophies. So that's the kind of muse that I see. But I do think of them as people who live in the basement. And in my mind, I equate that with the subconscious mind. And I think that down there, on whatever that level is, I probably still have a pretty good grasp of a lot of the things that I went through when I was, you know, in terms of consciousness, only partly there. So that maybe I could draw on that if I really needed to.
My guest is Stephen King. His new book is called On Writing. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Stephen King is my guest. His new book is called On Writing, A Memoir of the Craft. About a year before your accident, you had said that most writers have a finite number of stories to tell and that you suspected you were reaching your limit. And I'm wondering if the accident changed your feelings about that or changed the kind of story that you want to tell, lead you in any surprising and new directions.
I think any major accident is on life changer, but you're asking me, was it an art or a craft changer? And I don't really think so. Obviously, it has given me some new things to write about and some new experiences to put in stories, and I've already begun that procedure. Given a choice, if somebody had walked up to me and said, well, Steve, you can continue to live the same old, boring, healthy life. You won't have any real new experiences, and you can retire at 55, or you can go for the car accident. You can get hit by the van and put in the hospital, and you'll get some new experiences, and you can write until you're 60. Which do you choose? And immediately I would say, give me the boring life. I'll stop at 55. So I do have some new experiences, and I probably will write some other things and go on for a while. But, you know, there's a piece in the New York Times about Thomas Wolfe. A small press is reissuing Look Homeward, Angel in its entirety, which is a daunting idea because it's very big, even in the edition that was published by Scribner's back in the 20s and 30s. But this version is 60,000 words longer. I mean, 60,000 words is the length of Carrie, so this is a fairly long edition. And a lot of what Thomas Wolfe wrote was autobiographical. And he said something that struck me that's always stayed with me. Somebody asked him, what is your purpose as a writer? And Wolfe said, my purpose is to loot my life to the very walls, to loot my life to the very walls. And I think that every writer, particularly as they get a little bit older, you have more of a tendency to look back. I mean, first novels have a tendency to be almost unabashedly autobiographical. Later on, I think that writers look at their lives with a little more consideration, and as you get older, with a little more regret because you're aware of how much time has gone by. You have a tendency to use those experiences and use those insights until you get to a point where you say, I've started to recycle things that I said in the 80s or in some case in the late 70s. And when you get to that point, I think that you say, really, it's time to leave this table, to push back and to let it go. And I think that for me, what that means is there would come a time where I would simply cease publishing stuff, but I might go on writing because it's just fun.
Yeah, as you point out in your new book on writing, one of the plots that has interested you in several of your books is, if there is a God, why do such terrible things happen? Mm-hmm. And that's one of the themes in The Stand, Desperation, The Green Mile. Is that the kind of thing you were wondering about yourself after the accident? And I'm wondering if you believe in God, if you did before the accident, if you did after the accident.
Oh, I've always believed in God. I also think that's the sort of thing that either comes as part of the equipment, the capacity to believe, or at some point in your life, when you're in a position where you actually need help from a power greater than yourself, you simply make an agreement. I will believe in God because it will make my life easier and richer to believe than not to believe. So I choose to believe. Then, of course, you're left with these questions. Why did this happen to me? You know, there's a story that I've told a couple of times about Job. You know, the sorrows of Job. Job loses his wife. He loses his children. He's covered with diseases. His land is taken away from him. All these sorrows, and finally, Job goes down to the coast of the ocean and faces the waves and says, God, all these terrible things have happened to me, all these things, and I still love you, but I want to know why. Why did these things have to happen to me? Why did they have to happen to Job, your good and faithful servant? And this cyclone comes down, and it comes across the waves, and it stops in front of him, and it says, Job, I guess you just piss me off. And that's one way of looking at how God treats us. I can also say, God, why did this have to happen to me when, if I get another step back, you know, the guy misses me entirely? Then God says to me, in the voice that I hear in my head, which probably comes from the boys in the basement as much as from God, the muses that I have, the ones that, you know, basically tell me to get lost. I'm polishing my bowling trophies.
Mm-hmm.
These guys say, on the other hand, Steve, if you'd taken another step forward, you would have been killed. You didn't have any permanent nerve damage. You've got a numb place on your leg, but your foot works and your leg works. So there are all these things. And then these voices can go on and say, Steve, why don't you get serious? 6 million Jews were killed in the 30s and 40s as a part of Hitler's little ethnic cleansing program, and 1 million more Bosnian Serbs were killed in their program of ethnic cleansing in the mid-90s. So what are you complaining about? You got a little busted hip. Why don't you just, you know, pick yourself up and dust yourself off and get over it and don't be worrying about things you can't understand. So again, I think that you make an agreement and you say to yourself, okay, there's a God. Why? Because I choose to believe there's a God. Believing makes my life better than not believing. Why did this happen to me? It happened to me for some good purpose. What is that good purpose? I don't know, but I choose to believe it's good because to believe it's bad would bum out my whole day.
I had read that you were going to buy the van that struck you and smash it. Did that actually happen?
It never did happen. The van has been cubed. When I was in the hospital, mostly unconscious, my wife got a lawyer who's just a friend of the family. My son and his son went to school together, so we know him really well. And she got in touch with him and said, buy it so that somebody else doesn't buy it and decide to break it up and sell it on eBay, on the internet. And so he did, and for about 6 months, I did have these sort of fantasies of smashing the van up. But my wife, I don't always listen to her the first time, but sooner or later, she usually gets through, and what she says makes more sense than what I had planned. And her thought was that the best thing to do would be to very quietly remove it from this plane of existence, which is what we did.
Oh, and you can't say how?
Sure I can. It went through a car crusher. It's a little cube somewhere.
Oh, so rather than you attacking it yourself, I got it. Oh, that's...
Yeah.
And did you keep the cube?
No, I didn't. I don't really know what happened to the cube. But my idea about the van had always been to sort of smash it up the way that in the carnies of my youth, sometimes somebody would put a car up on in the back of a flatbed truck and charge a quarter for three smacks with a sledgehammer. And I thought we could do that for charity. And it still, at times, seems to me like a good idea. But I have sort of a carnival mind, and my wife is a little bit more sober.
So great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
It's so great to talk to you. Just to hear your voice in my headphones is nice.
Thank you, and continued good luck with your recovery. It sounds like you've really been doing terrifically so far. And thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for talking with me.
Stephen King's new book is called On Writing. Here he is singing Stand By Me, the song used in his film adaptation of the same name. Warren Zevon is at the piano.
This is where it all begins. When the night has come, the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see. I won't cry, no, I won't shed a tear, just as long as you stand by me. And darling, darling, stand. As long as you stand by me. Now listen, if the sky we look upon should crumble and fall, and the mountains should tumble into the sea, I won't cry, I won't cry. Just as long as you stand by me.
And darling, darling, stand by me.
Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of compositions by Samuel Barber. This is Fresh Air. The American composer Samuel Barber died in 1981, and except for a handful of pieces, most of his music doesn't get performed much. But classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that there's been a revival of interest in Barber's music. Here's Lloyd's review of a new reissue called The Music of Samuel Barber.
As the nephew of the famous Metropolitan Opera contralto Louise Homer and the life partner of the opera composer Giancarlo Menotti, it was inevitable that the American composer Samuel Barber would turn to opera. His first opera, the romantic melodrama Vanessa, had its world premiere in 1958 at the Metropolitan Opera and won the Pulitzer Prize. The plot is a little corny, but the music still holds up. The Met later commissioned from him a grand opera, Antony and Cleopatra, for the opening of its new house at Lincoln Center in 1966. But it was a bomb of atomic proportions, and Barber's reputation never quite emerged from under that mushroom cloud. In the last few years, though, there's been a neo-romantic revival. Audiences tired of atonality want to hear tunes they can remember. And Barber had a genuine gift for melody. His violin concerto and his setting of James Agee's Knoxville, Summer of 1915, for soprano and orchestra, have remained standard repertory items. And his moving adagio for strings, which was originally the slow movement of his string quartet, is so famous people know it without even knowing who wrote it. My favorite of Barber's three operas is a little gem, a 10-minute, four-character opera called A Hand of Bridge that he composed in 1959, the year after Vanessa. And like Vanessa, it has a libretto by Giancarlo Menotti. In it, we hear the inner thoughts of two married couples as they are playing their nightly bridge game. Geraldine is desperate about the impending death of her mother, the only person who has ever loved her. Her husband, David, frustrated by his subservient white-collar job, has sadomasochistic fantasies about 20 naked girls and 20 naked boys and drinking scented wine from cups of Steuben glass. Their friend Sally escapes from the boredom of her marriage by shopping and is currently obsessed with a hat of peacock feathers, while her husband, Bill, daydreams about his affair with a woman named Cymbeline in one of Barber's most seductive lyric tunes.
I want to buy that hat of peacock feathers. I want to buy that hat of peacock feathers. I want to buy that hat of peacock feathers. I saw this morning at Madame Charlotte's. Of course, there is the red one with the tortoiseshell rose, and then there is the beige with the fuchsia ribbon. Still, still, I think I'd buy that hat of peacock feathers from the table, darling.
I'm sorry, darling. wonder what she meant by always being dummy. Has she found out about Cymbeline? Cymbeline, Cymbeline, where are you tonight?
I want to buy that hat of paper.
Where are you tonight? On whose love are you wearing senseless night wet in your geranium's head of red? On whose black shoulder will you strew your blood hair? To whose bleeding violence will your breast surrender? Is it Christopher?
I want to buy that hat of peacock feathers.
Manfred, Chuck, Tommy, or Dominic.
I want to buy that hat of peacock feathers.
If it only were you, I might take off at the end of the game and strangle in the dark.
I want to buy that hat of peacock feathers. The Queen! You have trumped the Queen!
This isn't psychological profundity, but it's a vivid picture of 1950s middle-class anxieties and the verbal, melodic, and rhythmic juxtapositions. The skillful interweaving of the characters' internal thoughts with the card game they're playing are delicious. This album, Music of Samuel Barber, also includes several early choral and orchestral pieces, as well as the famous Adagio for Strings, in a performance led by the well-known cellist conductor Antonio Yanigro. In all their hands, some of the best music of the 1950s is still alive and well.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and the author of a new book of poems called Cairo Traffic. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Expanded Quotable Einstein, available in bookstores or online at www.pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with George Packer about his new memoir, Blood of the Liberals. It reflects on three generations of his politically liberal family and the circumstances that altered the ideals of each generation. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.